Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
I am your host, Tanya Communication Doctor, and the reason I do this show is because I want to provide a space for people to speak their authentic truth, coming from a heart space rather than a head space. Allow people to get into their space of consciousness, their space of confidence, and their space of connection. This, I think, promotes positive mental health, and this is why I do what I do. Hello, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have Michael D. Dillard. Hello, Michael.
Hey, aloha, Tanya. Aloha, sis. Shaka from Hawaii.
That's amazing. I was just going to say that. So you're calling in from Hawaii. So it's aloha to you. Yep. Brilliant. And I just want to say that Michael is the founder and CEO of I Am Global. Can you tell us a little bit more about I Am Global, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am technically is ION Global Contracting, but that name is so long, I always shorten it and I say ION Global. So ION Global is a federal contracting, it's a government contracting company, basically. And it's a twofold company in that we focus on training. So like, you know, CPR training, safety training, electrical training. But then on the other side, we focus on electrical maintenance and testing. So like, you know, the electrical gear that powers your buildings, it's called switch gear, transformers, breakers. We do all of that stuff also. But it's a government contract company. So my goal is to touch every aspect of the globe with my services. Right now, I'm just getting contracts in America, across America, but ultimately global. I Am Global will be a parent company, and I'll have all sorts of things. I have a lending company, I have training companies, I have airlines, I have all sorts of things. So that's the whole why it says global, right?
You know,
part of the vision, yeah.
That's really, really exciting. And I know what I love about doing podcasts is I started this podcast in November 2019.
So oh, wow.
People come on my show, and hopefully like in a year's time or in 2 years' time, you'll still mm-hmm. be able to have this podcast here, but it'd be interesting to see where your company goes in a year's time and so forth and so forth. And it's a nice way for people to look back as well, I do feel. So whatever you say here, you may mm-hmm. look back and say, God, I've moved on in the years. It'd be nice in a year's time to have you on the show and see how I Am Global has really moved on. But one of the reasons why I asked you to come on this show today wasn't really about your company, it was about you. Because I've had, after having a couple of conversations with you, I felt like, you know, it was so interesting as a Black man living in Hawaii, you've experienced so much. And I wanted to talk to you about your experiences because I feel like the Black male voice sometimes is not amplified enough from a space of revealing your true emotions, because we always reveal. And I even write down to my father, you know, my father was a man that loved to talk, but when I think about it, he never really spoke about his own experiences of racism. He would always speak about everybody else's. So that's where I kind of want to go today. So I'm going to take you on a journey where we're going to have a look at all aspects of you, and I'm going to start off by asking you to tell me if you can think of a time in your life, or a year, actually, let's go for a year in your life, in your childhood, that was really important to you, and why?
I would have to say that would probably be my 10th grade year, which would have been 86. And the reason I pick 86 is because, you know, I was always like, I was the nerd, right? So when everyone's playing sports, I always was reading comic books and you know, novels and whatnot. So you look at all of these old pictures of me, there's always a book. I'm like, man, how did I always have a book when I was a kid, right? So, you know, I just was nerdy. And then like the girls, they didn't really, you know, I wasn't, my brother is light skinned with curly hair, you know what I mean? And there's that thing with black and black people, right? Where even in the UK, right? Where there's dark blacks and then there's lighter blacks. And it's just, so anyway, the light skins was in, okay? But the dark brothers they wasn't feeling the dark brothers, right? So I had low self-esteem. But I knew people liked me in general. And then one day some girl came by and she was like, you know what? I'm gonna run for class president. And I just didn't like her attitude. She's like, you should vote for me, da, 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 da. And I'm like, why would I vote for you? She said, because I'm this and I'm that. And she was this and that, she really was. But I said, you know what? Nah. I said, I'm gonna run for class president and I'm gonna win, right? Go ahead then, right? So anyway, I ran and I won. Really? And I won, right? I won 2 years in a row. Okay, I know you said one story, but this is actually two stories. Because now I just remember, the first defining moment in my life in childhood, actually, when I didn't feel like I was a loser, I won the spelling bee in the sixth grade. So I was in a gifted and talented class. This guy's name was Mr. Marino. All the smart kids went to his class. So I remember one day, it was coming up on the spelling bee, and he was bragging to the class, like saying, hey, you know what? My class always wins the spelling bee. And I guess when people are full of themselves, it always rubs me the wrong way. And I'm like, oh, really? I'm gonna show you, right? So I was like, you shouldn't be bragging like all your people win. That's messed up. I'll show you. I'm gonna enter this spelling bee contest just so I could lose. I mean, like that was my mindset, just so I could lose. I'll show you. But mind you, you know, I always was reading, which meant I was always in the dictionary. So I was a killer speller. I didn't really think about it. Mm-hmm. Got in the spelling bee, and then I'm trying to figure out the right time for me to quit. And then I just keep advancing round after round after round. And then it got down to like five people, and I realized, I said, oh, wait a minute. I can win. I could actually win something, right? I'm going for it, right? So it got down to me and this girl, and they asked the girl, the word was hysteria. I'll never forget that. Hysteria. And in my mind, I said, most kids my age think hysteria is spelled like history. So if she says H-I, I know I won. And then she was like, hysteria, H-I. And I was like, yes! I'm going to win this thing.
You're like, H-I. H-I,
you know, I spelled it real fast, right? And I just remember, after I spelled it, like the whole auditorium went nuts because they knew I was like, I carried a trumpet. I always played a trumpet. I was reading a book. They just went nuts. It was like when Charlie Brown kicked the football, right? You know, they're like picking you up and carrying you. And it's like, that was like one of the happiest days of my life. Amazing. As a kid. I still remember the word that I won on, right? That was just nuts. But after that, that kind of helped me to curve and start feeling like, okay, I'm smart. I'm accepted. And that's why eventually I would go on and be class president for 2 years. But
that's really interesting. And what I just wrote down there as I'm listening to you was, it's interesting that you picked two moments in your life, in your childhood, that were successes. And just listening to your language, it was like, it's interesting, you looking back at people who were challenging you and you're like, I'll show you, meaning,
yeah,
you know, you're going to actually shine, or you're going to show that you can do this. So that's a sense of a competitiveness, isn't it? That you can be competitive. So where does that competitiveness come from? Have you always been like that, or do you think it's something within your family? Where does that come from, that where you feel like, I'll show you? Or is it that you just feel a need to be acknowledged?
That's good. I'm sure on some level, you know, I do like to be acknowledged. Yeah, you ain't gonna ignore me. You're not gonna stick baby in the corner, right? That's me. But I know that I get this also from my mom, though. My mom is from Missouri, and she always used to say, Missouri is the show me state. That's what they call it, the show me state. So I'll show you. Yeah, so I got it from my mom. Watching her do stuff, if somebody tells she can't do something, please. You know, she may not have money, but I'll fix that refrigerator. I'll fix the TV. You know, it's like, she gonna figure out how to do it. And so I'm quite certain I got that from my mom. Yeah.
That's really interesting as well. I mean, I totally resonate with that as well, because I'm quite like that myself as a person as well. When someone tells me I can't do something, I have to prove that I can do it. And
got to.
When I looked back at it, I thought part of that did come from, you know, I want to prove to everyone that I'm capable. But then I looked in deeper and thought, okay, this is about me partly being the young. I went in deeper to look at the sixth child, the youngest, not always being or recognised. Mm-hmm. So sometimes if you look deeper, there's always something there. But it's interesting what you said about your mother being very, you sound like she's superwoman. She's fixing everything. She's doing everything.
My mom was amazing. She's still alive. She's amazing. She's still doing all types of stuff. I called her like 3 weeks ago. Mom, what you doing? Yeah, I'm up on the roof doing so-and-so. What are you doing on the roof? Like, Mom, come. You know, I know my mom, right? She's like a tomboy. She's going to do it, right? But still, it's like, Mom, you're 70 years old. Like, what do you mean you're on the roof? Wow. I'm on the roof doing so-and-so. Yeah, that's my mom.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Mm-hmm. Your mum sounds amazing. I want to meet her right now. Maybe I should have her on the show. Okay. So moving kind of into that, you're looking at all those lovely light times. And from another perspective, I'm going to ask you to be probably a little bit vulnerable here, because I'm going to ask you about picking a year in your life, looking back, that was the most challenging for you and why?
Oh, wow. In my childhood or just in my life?
In your life, you can look back wherever you feel.
I know that, right? I know that. So in my early 20s, I was 23. So I married this young lady, I fell in love with her, and she ended up having a very, very bad drug problem, very bad. Both of my daughters came from this woman. Now, me and her was only married 2 years. The drugs were so bad, she wouldn't let go. I tried to, you know, put her in therapy, but she wouldn't do it. And I finally had to get away just for our safety and well-being of the kids, right? But what happened was, after I got divorced from her, I wasn't even divorced yet. The long and the short of it was, before I got out the military, people told me, because I got out the military for 2 years, when all hell broke loose, and then I went back in. So before I got out, they said, look, Mike, you shouldn't get out the military because you're young, you know, you have a kid, a wife, you don't have money saved up. And I was like, no, I got this. I'm very confident. I can do anything, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, okay, it's a bad plan. I didn't listen to the wisdom, right? I got out, and my unemployment was gone in 6 months. In America, you get 6 months, at least back then, that was it. I thought that I was going to be like making all this money selling life insurance. I didn't know the industry. I didn't understand. Like, if you close a sale in life insurance, it's considered, your commissions are considered an advance. It's like a loan. So if the customer cancels their policy in the first year, guess what? You got to pay that money back. So yeah, I can go out there and sell, but guess what? In Hawaii, everyone's family, right? So you replace somebody's insurance policy, it was their cousin. Hey cousin, why you replace that policy? Man, put it back on. So then I lost all these policies. All the money's gone. So I lost all that money from there. My unemployment ran out. I had nothing. And then my wife at the time, her drug problem really ramped up, which of course, because she's stressed out. Her man wasn't taking care of. I was immature, honestly, back then. And she ended up going to California to stay with family. And I stayed back here and I ended up being homeless for a little bit.
Oh gosh.
Wow. I had no money. We got evicted. Got evicted, right? So I basically was living in my car, a 1990 Nissan Sentra XC, a little red box car. I was sleeping in my car, and then the car was breaking. I would have to find the hill to roll the car down because the starter wouldn't really work, right? So if you got a stick shift, you can kind of kickstart it, they call, right? You kind of start the car rolling, and then you can jump in and start it. It'll go, right? I mean, that was my life. It was stressful, right? And I just remember I hardly had anything. And then we got back together. Me and her got back together. And I remember I had just found God and I was praying to God. I was like, God, you know, please, I need a job. Anything. I'll take anything. And then all of a sudden, like, this job opened up at a bread truck company, right? And so I went to apply for the job. I didn't even have the right license. The dude in front of me had the right license, but the guy hired me. He hired me. Wow. Yeah. And the job was decent. I mean, I think it paid something like $900 a week. And after the first 6 months, then it ramped up. But I was a route relief driver. So what's happening is, I'm not trying to eat up all your time, but what happened was A route relief driver is the guy that goes in and takes over the route from these people that have been driving for 15, 20 years. They know the route from all the stores around. They know this stuff. You got to come in and learn it in 2 days.
Wow.
2 days. So what happened was, by this time, my car was totally gone. It had gotten impounded and I didn't have the money to get it out. So I lost my car. Even though I had paid it off in full, I lost the car, it was gone. So I would have to take the bus across the island, the very last bus at night, to the bread company. And then I'd sleep in the break room until like 3 a.m. when everyone's coming in. And then I wake up, they load the truck and I go out. So I remember just doing this and I was just hating my job. I just hated it. Cause I was like, I don't want to be in this place. I don't want to be here. Most of the people was like, hey, I've been here 15, 20 years. And I'm like, that's not me. I'm meant for greater things than that, you know? And I remember one day I was driving, everything was ramping up. Her drug problem was ramping up. We was arguing back and forth. And it's like, she's taking my kid out and she's hanging out with drug dealers and prostitutes. Oh, and it's just, I was freaking out. And I remember it was my 25th birthday. I'll never forget it. I call it my bread truck breakdown, right? Mm-hmm. I was driving this bread truck across the island and I was listening to, I wasn't listening to nothing. I was driving and I was just thinking, I heard a thought in my mind and it said, I could see me doing this for the rest of my life. Like, I'd be willing to do this to take care of my, you know, my family, even though I knew she was out cheating on me, whatever else, right? And when I heard that thought in my head, I freaked out. I just started screaming in the truck, I tapped my lungs, and I was like, no, no. You know, I'm meant for more than this. This is not my life. It's not my life. No, I'm like literally freaking out. I'm crying. I'm screaming. Snot's coming out of my nose. I mean, crazy, right? And I just remember yelling, like, I cried the whole way there. And I was like, God, please, you know, I'll do anything. You got to get, this is not my life. You got to get me out of this. And then like 2 days after that, somebody introduced me to like some Tony Robbins tapes. Not that I'm advocating Tony Robbins, but it really helped me to shape my mindset. And my whole life just turned around after that. So the hardest period of my life was that period right there when I was homeless, semi-homeless, and then dealing with her and the drugs and the people that she was involved with and all that stuff. And I was broke as a joke. It was just, it was so hard. It was just so hard.
You know what? That sounds tough to me. And this is a real, real story. That's why I like doing this show. And I like getting to the heart of some of these stories where people are so honest about some of the struggles. But what I, as I'm listening to you and hearing what you're saying, is you kept saying I was meant for more than this. And I feel that's really powerful because it's that belief system, you know? So even though you're in that situation, which probably be quite a hard situation, given what your wife at the time was, you know, was in that kind of having that experience with regards to drugs and so forth, you still believed that there is greater things for you and there's more for you. And I feel everything starts with belief, doesn't it? If you don't believe in yourself,
yeah,
you can't expect anyone else to believe in you. And well, some people do believe in you, but it comes from self, doesn't it? And then that's, I feel like that's what you're speaking to the universe, because it's almost like on a subconscious level, you're saying, I believe in greater things. And as you're a Christian, you're asking God for greater things.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, it's like, God, Jesus, however you want to interpret, answers your prayers. So that's really powerful. You also mentioned within that story that you're in the military, and I find that quite interesting. How do you want to tell us a little bit about that in terms of how you got into the military? Because, you know, that's not something you generally, I don't know, is that something that you wanted to do from a young age? Tell you know what I mean?
Oh, no. No, so my mom raised all of us up to go to college, right? It was like, you're going to go to college. So, of course, the rebellious streak in me is like, I don't know about that. And plus, I was scared to go to college. I had this one teacher in school. His name was Mr. Doobie. He was kind of like this bald-headed guy. And his, I don't know where he would get these clothes. And he matched these clothes and have these short little fat ties. All the students would just be roaming like, Mr. Doobie, man, where's the dude get his clothes from? But this guy, his classes was advanced reading development, ARD, right? Yeah. And you come in class and he go, students, please believe me, college is a 4-year reading course. And he just talked about how hard it was and the you have to have a master vocabulary, this and that. And honestly, inside, I was terrified. I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I'm smart enough to go to college, right? So what happened was I was taking a shortcut I was cutting class. So this is how I got in the Navy, because my calculus teacher, so I had calculus, I think I was in like the 10th grade, I had a calculus teacher. His name is Mr. Gold. He taught at Rutgers University also. So he didn't teach like most of the teachers. He's like, hey, I'm gonna teach you like a professor would teach you. And he was very laid back, exact opposite of Mr. Doobie. He's like, if you guys wanna cut class, cut class. If you wanna go get some food, get good food, right? Because that's how it is in college. Only thing I ask is that you bring me some food. Oh, okay. So me and my two best friends, we hatched this plot. We're like, you know what? IHOP, International House of Pancakes, they were selling like all you can eat seafood combo. It was like $9.99, but it was like two towns away. So we're like, okay, how can we cut class and then come back in Mr. Gold's class with the food and eat it in class, right? So it was like, oh, you know what? The adjunct, they're giving military testing. So we can take a military test, just write all C's down or whatever. And then we can just cut through the parking lot. So since we were the smart kids, I'm like, you know what? The security guards aren't going to bother us, because if they ask where you go, I'll give them like some nerdy answer. Oh, we're going to get the so-and-so for Mr. So-and-so, right? And go ahead, right? They just let us go because we were the nerdy kids. We're supposed to be the good kids, right? So we cut class, went, got this food, came back. Now, I had no intention of going to the military, but because I took the test, then they started calling me, right? So somebody called me for the Air Force. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to join the Air Force. Then my mom's like, no, you're not. Then I'm like, yes, I am, right? So I ended up not going in the Air Force because while my recruiter was on vacation, somebody from the Navy approached me with the nuclear power program, which totally fed my ego. I'm like, I'm going to do nuclear power, nuclear engineering. So that's how I ended up going in the Navy.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah, that's how I ended up going in the Navy. And when I got in the Navy, it was a totally different world. Mm. The military is a totally different world than what you're used to. If you're not a military person, you don't get it. And I just took to it. So when other people was crying in boot camp and this and that, I was just loving it, running laps and doing push-ups. And I loved it. I embraced it. You know what it was? I found order, and I had order and structure. And my mom's a great mom. I'm not saying anything bad about her, but I think the level of structure in the household that we had, it wasn't enough for me. Like when you have people with a higher intellect, and I'm just saying, if you have people higher, they have to be challenged in a certain way. They have to be reined in a certain way. And I don't necessarily know, in conversations with my mom, now I know this too. She wasn't really sure like what to do with me.
Yeah, yeah.
According to her, I was free.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, she didn't know what to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I grew and I flourished in the military.
Brilliant, brilliant. I suppose it is challenging, I suppose, sometimes having son. I do feel daughters and sons are challenging in different ways, aren't they? And and sometimes when it comes to like discipline and all that sort of thing, sometimes men, is you have to really understand your boys, don't you? On lots of different levels. And you've got all of these different other restrictions. Because it is scary sometimes having, I've got a son as well, having a male. I love my boy to the bones, but you do worry about them a lot, especially coming out to this world, especially when you were growing up in America, you know, and there's all that racism.
Oh, yeah.
You told me a story the other week about when you know a story which was kind of scared me a little bit in terms of what happens and what your experiences was with regards to growing up as a young black male in the States. Could you tell my audience that story that you told me last week? Because I found it really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Before I do that, so I was talking to one of my daughters yesterday. She's in Berkeley. This is the activist. She does tech sales, but in her heart, she's always like the activist. I always worry about her because I know she's going to be in the middle of something, you know, rallying or whatnot, right? But anyway, she told me like she got stopped by a police officer the other day. She was just walking her dog in a park and they stopped her and was questioning her. They basically let her go, but you know, I was like, are you okay? Were you scared? And she's always real strong, but you know, she let out and say, yeah, I was scared then. You know, I was scared, but I'm okay, right? And then I told her the story that I told you. So I never told her this story. I had never told her this story. So I told her this story yesterday and she was like, oh my God, like, are you serious? So I was nine, I was visiting my grandma. I'm from New Jersey, but my grandma lived in Missouri, Haytown, Missouri, which we all know is the Bible Belt. There's a lot of racism, overt racism down there. And this was during the 70s. So this would have been like 1979. I was nine. My little brother Derek was seven and my little cousin Daryl was five. Mm. So there was a store called Hayes, Hayes Five and Dime. You had to walk. My grandma didn't have a car, so we had to walk from her house over to Hayes, which is probably like, I don't know, almost like an hour walk. But on the way there, there's a zoo. It's a park with a little zoo. And I remember the zoo had like this old lion with like a raggedy tooth. There was an old fat bear in there and something else. I mean, just, they didn't take care of the animals, right? But they had animals there. There was a playground in there also. So we didn't go to the playground. We was passing by it. And then there was these, I think it was like three white guys and then two white boys, kids, right? And the white guys had shotguns. So they walked up to us and then they're pointing the shotguns at us, right? And the lead one, and forgive me for using the N-word, but the lead one says, well, let me ask you, can I use the N-word on this
podcast? You know, you could, yeah, whatever, if it's for this, you know, the story, as you're telling the story, it's fine. I feel like, you know, okay. We're sorry to offend. We're not doing this to offend. It's just for the purposes of the story. So that's fine. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So the one lead guy walks up to me, gun-toted out at my face, and he's like, hey, nigger. He says, my little brother here was over here in the playground on a merry-go-round. He says some nigger knocked him off, scraped his knee up. So, of course, I look at the little boy's knee. It is scraped up and it's bleeding. He says, I think you did it. And I said, no, sir, it was not me. So I told my brother and cousin, I said, get behind me. I'm nine. I'm like, get behind me. And he says, yeah, nigger, I think you're the one that did it. I said, sir, me and my brother and cousin, we were at my grandma's house all day. We're just going to Hayes Five and Dime to get some ice cream. We were never in the playground. So then, you know, and the guns are still at us. They're still pointing at us. And then he looked at his little brother. He said, is this the nigger that pushed you off? He said, no. He said, you sure that's not the nigger that pushed you off the merry-go-round? He said, no, that's not him. He said, boy, this is your lucky day. Get on out of here. And they put the guns down. And let's go. We walked off. So I didn't tell my grandmother. I basically was terrified. Cool. I was nine and they're pointing these shotguns at my face, right? So I suppressed the story. I never even told my mom. So by the time I told my mom, I'm not even making this up. I was like 40. I'm 50 now. I think I was like 40 or 41. And what happened was, I guess I just suppressed it. And one day it just popped to the surface. And I was like, oh my God, how did I forget that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was traumatized, you know? So
of course. I mean, when you told me that story just the other week, I was like, wow. And it was my son's birthday just day, and he just turned nine. And I just looking at how innocent he is and just how tiny and innocent and beautiful he is. And I'm thinking a nine-year-old having to go through that, it really got me actually, because it's really horrible.
Yeah.
And it just shows you, that was in the 70s, yeah? It shows you the state of America. But if you think about it, that was in the 70s. Now, just recently, mm-hmm. 2020, we're still fighting, aren't we? There's on some level, they're still fighting.
Absolutely.
Trying to get justice. So Black people can be seen as human beings. And I think it's as simple as that, because
yes.
To put a shotgun in a child's face is dehumanizing, isn't it? You know, and also it is dehumanizing. It's just disgusting, really, and some of the things that are happening right now. Part of that is a prejudice and with regards to how people are looked upon. And then, I mean, also, you're a bit of a poet, aren't you? And you wrote this amazing poetry just the other day. I think this will go out a little bit later, but this is for Martin Luther King's Day. Would you like to share some of that with us? Because it's just really interesting how, you know, someone like Martin Luther King, you know, he didn't believe in violence, did he? He believed in peace, love. Right. But there's another level to that in terms of, you know, people, he needs to be listened to. He was listened to a certain degree, but I feel to get things done, you think about all of these activists, maybe nothing was done because maybe they had too much love, you know, maybe things need to go to another level to get things done. I don't know, but it was just interesting. But would you like to share some of that poetry with us that my audience really strong?
Yeah, like, thank you for that. Mm. So my moniker or pen name or pseudonym, however you want to label it, is Black Steel. So Black, I spell it different. It's B-L-A-Q-U-E, and then Steel is S-T-E-E-L-E. So Like, I remember the show Remington Steel, so I always liked that, right? The steel way spelled it, right?
And I just think Black people are so talented, you know? I just feel that as well. You know, you go through so much, and I feel sometimes that energy has to go somewhere, and I always find it fascinating when it goes into the arts. So when I read like, this is just like, it has to go somewhere, because you're feeling all of this energy, but it has to go somewhere. So I'll let you speak.
No, and the cool thing, which was unexpected, I mean, I literally wrote this on Martin Luther King. I got up and I'm like, Lord, please help me write a poem today. I got the title like 3 or 4 days ago. And I know when I have a title, the way I look at it, I don't really create the poem. I believe God puts the poem inside of me. So it's like a chisel. What do you call it? Like a, the guy that's chiseling.
The chisel.
You know, you chisel. I forgot the title, what they actually call themselves, but they make statues, right? And I've heard it said that...
Oh, the sculptor.
A sculptor can see the image inside the stone. That's the way their gift works. Hmm. So they look at that stone, they see it inside the stone. That's how they can just cut out so perfectly, because they see it perfectly inside of them. Hmm. So for me, that's how poems are. It's like, I'm not really making a poem. I hear a title, my youngest daughter's the same way. I hear the phrase and I'm like, oh, there's a poem in there. So then it's just a matter of sitting down and just unpacking it. Like, okay, let me sit and listen and wait, and it just starts coming up and coming out. So the title is Black Box. And I was thinking about like the black box material for the airplanes. Why don't they make planes out of it? The planes crash, the black box always is found, but the plane is crashed. Like, man, that's strong. Oh, black box, that's like black. Oh man, I got it right. So I wrote this yesterday. I just sat up and I said, okay, black box. Okay. Don't get me started with that mouth.
I know, but it's like your trailer. You're giving us your whole trailer for. I'm loving that trailer for. But I'm going to be quiet now. I'm going to just listen to this.
Okay. The black box.
We're going to read the poem now. Yeah, Michael? Yeah, I'm going to read the poem.
All right. Black Steel is in the house now. Okay.
Go for it.
Real talk, the legacy of the Dark Continent is not that of blood diamonds and fire opals, but rather one of its people, though divided, still unique, unbroken, and in our strength, we are unequaled. Cultured, refined, royal, imperial, impervious to destruction like that black box material, always everlast, both present and past, face slavery, hatred and social injustice, yet we still walked off boldly from its aftermath. Please, you couldn't walk a mile in these shoes, even if you choose. Yeah, you dig our rhythms, but you don't want our blues. Despite centuries of unjust oppressors stepping on our backs, we stand straight and tall. Shoulders back, heads high like the royals we are, our gaze steady, focused on the highest of stars. Black box, baby. Black box, baby.
Woo! I love it. I do. And I had to write that down again because there was a line in there that really got me. And I love it. You know, you dig our rhythm, but you don't want our blues. And for me, that really got me in terms of cultural appropriation, you know, in terms of just that whole connection with the Black experience and the whole connection with Black history and Black music and Black poetry. And, you know, exactly. I think about Langston Hughes, I can rail off the names, Maya Angelou, all these great people that have come before us, you know, James Bond, amazing playwright. Right now we've got Tyler Perry. The guy's got the studio. Yeah, so it's there's so many amazing artists out there doing amazing things. And it's like when you said you dig our rhythm, but you don't want our blues, in terms of you don't want that, you love the experience, you love to hear about it, but who really wants to experience what a black man has to experience? But the other level to that is when you do experience what you do experience, it makes you stronger. And it does. I feel like it makes you so much more in tune. And I mean, I just think, I love my people. I love our experience. It's a tough experience and it is blue for me. It's like sometimes when I hear that bass line, I used to dance, like when I hear that bass line, you know, and I see African dance, or I even see Alvin. When I saw Alvin Ailey Dance Company for the first time, I thought, God, no one dances like that, you know?
Right.
No one dances like that. And that's kind of part of the Black experience, because when you watch, even like I say, even Nina Simone's, when you hear Nina Simone sing, you hear her pain.
Yeah.
And that pain just makes that music sound amazing. If someone's going to sing a Nina Simone song without having that experience, it means nothing, you know?
Right.
And that's what things, that's really powerful. So thank you so much for sharing your poetry and also being able to go to that place to release what you're feeling, you know, just to get it out there. Yeah. Just to get it out there. So that must just feel good. And you put that out, didn't you? And it must just feel good.
Yeah, and that's why at the end of the poem, I was like, I love it, I love it. Because what I got, I walked away with a greater appreciation for being a Black man and being a part of Black people. And that's why after I wrote this poem, honestly, I mean, I got friends all over the world. I just started putting it out, sending it out, sending it out, sending it. I'm like, you know what? I wrote this in honor of Dr. King and Black people all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I know in the UK, so you guys don't have MLK Day, but, you know, Dr. King was our treasure. You know, he's one of our treasures globally, you know, as a people, communally. So when I got done writing that poem, I was just like, I'm so proud to be a Black man. I'm so proud to be a part of Black people and the heritage. And just, I didn't expect that side effect of writing the poem. But then as I'm getting feedback from all of these people around the world, they're getting the same feedback. It's resonating within them the same way. Like, I'm proud to be a Black person. Like, yeah, that's right. We are broken. We're kind of a diaspora. We're still all over the place, you know? And I was in the Navy, I traveled all over the world, right? So you see Black people. Well, one thing a buddy of mine told me, he was Ecuadorian. He'd say, you know what, from New York, he'd be like, I don't know what it is with you Black guys, right? Black people, you know, you guys see each other no matter where you are. You guys, you know, you do the head shake. Like, what is that about? What's that about, right? Like, you know, I guess it's just a Black thing. You don't understand it. It didn't matter whether it was African, Jamaican. If you Black, you Black. It's like, you know what? We all been through it. We all been through it, right? So, yeah.
And that's so true. I mean, because, you know, my dad is Jamaican. And you know, we lived in quite a white area, but we knew all the Black people within the area, you know, and it's that simple nod. And I even do it here when I moved here. Someone, I just kind of say, all right, or I smile, I say, all right, give a nod. And it's just that connection. Right. But not everybody, I think what's happening, we're losing that with the younger generation, I suppose, because their experience has been different. And even going all around the world, it's interesting you say about there's not a Martin Luther King Day, but I suppose, like, he's a major activist. I really love Martin Luther King, but I suppose looking at us the racism is still very strong within Europe, but in a different way, you know? I suppose you've got the guns in your faces, but I feel like from the British experience, it's more psychological, I do feel. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the experience, you look deeply into what's been said to you and the way things have been said, I think it's more on a psychological level, which is just as damaging, but damaging in a different way. And I actually thought about Marcus Garvey as well, being kind of one of our heroes as well, and also being my parents of Jamaican heritage. He was very much somebody who was, you know, huge at that sort of time. So I suppose if you talk to different people around the world, Martin Luther King, other people will come up, Martin Luther King, you know, Marcus.
And Ali, we talked about Ali earlier, right?
I mean, yeah, I'm a lover of Muhammad Ali. I just feel, because the fact that he said no, for me, the fact that he said no to the Vietnam War and said, no, I'm not going, that just takes some kind of balls, doesn't it? You know?
Exactly. And it's really why he said no.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing, right? So I mean, I to this day, if I'm like feeling a little down, I need some motivation, I'm putting on a YouTube video, Ali, Boumaye, Ali. Yeah. I remember that movie came out. I was in my house screaming, Ali, Boumaye, Boumaye. Oh, man, that guy is something else, man. You know, but he's our treasure. You know what I mean? He's gone now, but he's our treasure worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing how you can get people around the world as big as it is, and we can connect over a person, over an incident, or, you know, something that brings us all together and says, yes, we are still connected as one, you know, in some type of way globally. That's powerful.
It is powerful. It is powerful. And I think what's so beautiful now is even the fact that we're connecting now, you know, with regards to being through Zoom. The power of social media, the power of connecting with people around the world, the power of me having this conversation with you today on this podcast, and being able to share it with other people who may have had a similar experience, or just to hear about your experience and connect, even if it's not the same experience, but just to connect, because everybody's experience is so unique. I think that's powerful within itself now, where years ago, you know, you could only hear or read about other people's experiences unless you traveled. When you go travel, you speak to people. But I think that's a beauty I feel with the podcast as well, for myself, to be able to speak to different people around the world and have that experience. So thank you so much for coming on my show today. And I just wondered if, you know, moving forward, in, you know, we spoke about a lot. So we spoke about your challenges. We spoke about your art in terms of your poetry. We spoke about your experience from what you experienced in terms of racism. So there's so much there. But what would you like to leave my audience with? Is there any words of inspiration or quotes that you'd like to share, or word, or a quote from yourself maybe? What would you like to tell my audience now?
I appreciate the platform. I'll be gentle. No, what I want to tell people is that no matter what you're going through, right, there all, and this may sound cliche, but there always is hope. There's always hope. And even if there's bad stuff, I've learned about gratitude. Like, there is a power in gratitude, whether you're a Christian or not. You know, Bible teaches us about giving thanks. But I learned, like, when you start giving thanks, even for bad stuff, like, if you look for something that's good in it, it kind of strengthens you in a weird sort of way. And it's almost palpable. And you can get up and you can move on. So I would say, if there's one thing, I would just say, really be intentional about being grateful and about putting beauty in front of you. So there's beauty all around us. So even if you're in a concrete jungle, guess what? Sometimes flowers grow up through the concrete. Yeah. You know, you got to look, you got to be intentional and look for the beauty, because otherwise your mind is just naturally going to stay focused on the negatives, and you can't do that. You have to choose peace. My daughter, she always makes peaceful stuff. So that's our thing. Choose peace. And, you know, you choose to be positive, and somehow it will, well, I know it's God, but it's going to right itself. You're going to come out of it eventually, and you're going to be way better and way stronger.
You know what? That's just beautiful, and a beautiful way to end the show today. And I totally agree with you. Just choose peace. Just choose peace.
Yes.
Now that connection. Well, thank you so much. I'm just going to say from
telling you. You're welcome. My pleasure.
Oh, thank you. No, it's been really great talking to you today. Really, really lovely talking. So thank you for coming on the show and sharing your experience and opening up to me and opening up to the you know, to the podcast listeners and so forth. So just want to say from Taylor Communication Doctor, as you know, look, how to say goodbye in Hawaii. Come and give us a goodbye.
Okay.
And from
my Aloha.
There you go. Aloha.
You can say ahui ho. It's like aloha, see you later. Aloha, ahui ho.
Ahui ho. All right, let's do it together. Let's go. Aloha,
ahui ho. Aloha, ahui ho. You got to do the shaka.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Cool. You're welcome.
One of my takeaways from this show was that Michael was able to release his pain through poetry. And he said, no matter what you're going through, always have hope. I thought that was a really powerful takeaway. He also talked about the power in gratitude and looking for beauty everywhere, even in the darkest of places. He talked about choosing peace and choosing positive. And it's interesting that he used that word choose, because in life we can choose to be who we want to be. And we can choose to be positive. And that's why I feel like I want to call this podcast Just Choose Peace. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. And to listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.